If you would turn in your Bibles this morning to 1 Samuel chapter 17, 1 Samuel 17, we will read the entire chapter. Now, the Philistines gathered their armies together and were gathered at Soko, which belongs to Judah. They encamped between Soko and Azekah in Ephrathdamim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together, and they encamped in the valley of Elah, and drew up in battle array against the Philistines. Then the Philistines stood on a mountain on one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side, with a valley between them. And a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines, named Goliath, from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat of mail was 5,000 shekels of bronze. He had a bronze armor on his legs and a bronze javelin between his shoulders. Now the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his iron spearhead was 600 shekels, and a shield bearer went before him. Then he stood and cried out to the armies of Israel and said to them, "Why have you come up to the line of battle? Am I not a Philistine, and you the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves, and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and to kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the armies of Israel today. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and all of Israel heard these words of this Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Now David was the son of an Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse, and who had 8 sons. The man was old and advanced in years in the days of Saul. The 3 oldest sons of Jesse had gone to follow Saul to the battle. The names of his 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, next to him, Aminadab, and the 3rd, Shammah. David was the youngest, and the 3 oldest followed Saul. But occasionally David went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. And the Philistines drew near and presented himself 40 days, morning and evening. Then Jesse said to his son David, "Take now for your brothers an ephah of this dried grain and these 10 loaves, and run to your brothers at the camp, and carry these 10 cheeses to the captain of their 1,000, and see how your brothers fare, and bring back news of them." Now Saul and they all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. So David rose early in the morning and left the sheep with a keeper, and took the things and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the camp as the army was going out to fight, shouting for battle. For Israel and the Philistines had drawn up in battle array, army against army. And David left his supplies in the hand of the keeper, ran to the army, and came and greeted his 3 brothers. Then as he talked with them, there was the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, coming up from the armies of the Philistines. And he spoke according to the same words, so David heard them. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him, for they were dreadfully afraid. So the men of Israel said, "Have you come up and seen this man? Surely he has come to defy Israel. And it shall be that the man who kills him, the king will enrich with great riches and give him his daughter and give his father's house exemption from taxes in Israel." Then David spoke with the men who stood by him, saying, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine, that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And the people answered him in this manner, "So it shall be done for the man who kills him." Now Eliab, his oldest brother, when he spoke to the men and Eliab's anger was aroused against David, he said, "Why did you come here? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride and the insolence of your heart, for you have come to see the battle." And David said, "What have I done now? Is there not a cause?" Then he turned from him and toward another and said the same things. And these people answered him the same as the first ones did. Now when the words which David spoke were heard, they reported them to Saul, and he sent for them. And David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with the Philistine." And Saul said to David, "You are not able to fight this Philistine with him, for you are youth, and he is a man of war from his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant used to keep his father's sheep. And when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went after it and struck it and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when he arose and caught me, I caught it by its beard and struck it and killed it. Your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing that he has defied the army of the living God." Moreover, David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of the Philistine." And Saul said to David, "Go, and the Lord be with you." So Saul clothed David with his armor, and he put a bronze helmet on his head, and he also clothed him with a coat of mail. David fastened the sword to his armor, and he tried to walk, for he had not tested them. And David said to Saul, "I cannot walk with these, for I have not tested them." So David took them off. Then he took the staff in his hand, and he chose for himself 5 smooth stones from the brook, and he put them in a shepherd's bag, in a pouch which he had, and his sling in his hand, and he drew near to the Philistine. So the Philistine came and began drawing near to David, and the man who bore the shield went before him. And when the Philistine looked about and saw David, he disdained him, for he was only a youth, ruddy and good-looking. So the Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you have come to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, "Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the field." Then David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with sword, with spear, and with javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver me into your or deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you. And I will this day give the carcass of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and to the wild beasts of the field, that the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Then all this assembly shall know that the Lord does not save with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give it into our hands." So it was when the Philistine arose, and he came near to meet David, that David hurried and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. Then David put his hand in the bag and took out a stone, and he slung it and struck the Philistine in the forehead, so that the stone sank into his forehead and he fell face to the earth. So David, prevailing over the field with a sling in the stone, and struck the Philistine and killed him. But there was no sword in the hand of David. Therefore David ran and stood over the Philistine, took his sword, drew it out of its sheath, and killed him, and cut off his head with it. And when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. Now the men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the entrance of the valley gates of Ekron. And the wounded of the Philistines fell along the road to Shearim, even as far as Gath and Ekron. Then the children of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines, and they plundered their tents. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, and he put his armor in his tent. When Saul saw David going out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, who was the commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is this youth?" And Abner said, "As your soul lives, O king, I do not know." So the king said, "Inquire whose son this young man is." Then David returned from the slaughter of the Philistine. Abner took him and brought him before Saul, with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" So David answered, "I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite."
For just a few moments, we are in this great account of what is often known as David and Goliath in 1 Samuel chapter 17. This has to be one of the most well-known and well-beloved stories, accounts, in all of the Bible. In fact, not just for Christians, everywhere, just about anyone knows at least the reference to David and Goliath. As Christians, we know this account very well too. As a little boy, I learned the song, Only a Boy Named David, Only a Little Sling. I can remember the flannel graphs, you know, those pictures pasted up on that flannel graph as a little boy. They don't do that anymore. They got colorful posters instead for Sunday school now. We know this story very well. So I was asked this week by someone, what can a preacher say about such a well-known and well-beloved story account in the Bible? So I thought I would start by just irritating some people by telling you what the story is not about. Because some people, even though they know this story really, really well, have some wrong ideas about what this text is about. So this text is not about facing whatever Goliaths you have in your life. That's how some people interpret this text. You have great challenges in your life. God is the great giant killer. You believe in God, go for it, and God will help you. You have the giant of finances. God can take that down. You have the giant of relationships. God can take that giant down. You have the giant of health or marriage troubles, and on the list goes. God can take all of those down. Now, this passage may give us hope for some of those areas, but that's not really what it's about. Other people look at this text and they see lots of symbolism. I was joking with Pastor Greg and another man in our church on Wednesday night about what the five stones mean. There are people who have assigned historically all sorts of symbolic meanings to those stones. Other people preach this text and teach this text as full of religious symbolism. David is like Jesus who defeated death. We can get lost in this story because we know it well, but we also can get lost in this story running into interpretations before we carefully consider what is it that the author of Samuel wanted to communicate both to the original readers and what would God want us to hear today. You see, when we study the Bible, we always start with the attempt to understand what the author of the text wanted to say to his original audience. And if you do that and you read it carefully, if you're in 1 Samuel 17 in its larger context, we might get something like this. The author of 1 Samuel 17 shows that David, unlike King Saul, he saw things as God saw them. David didn't trust human measuring sticks or human means alone to make God's will be done. No matter what he faced, he put his confidence in God's ways, in God's promises. Unlike King Saul, who put his trust in armor, David put his trust in the Lord. And as soon as we see that truth coming out of 1 Samuel 17, we recognize that this passage does, in fact, have much life for us today. Because the challenge that David faced in trusting in the Lord is really at its heart no different than we face when we do face challenges in our lives. Now, what we're going to do very briefly, and I mean very briefly, is to try to just walk our way through this account. I'm going to note a few things that often cause some confusion, and then we'll come back and think about just one application for us, and our time will be done. Now, as we work our way through this account, I'm going to divide this chapter into six sections. The first is the Israelite challenge, and you see that in the first 11 verses. Well, the Philistines, of course, they have this champion in verse number 4 whose name is Goliath, and he's marching out every day, morning and evening, for 40 days straight in a valley. And the picture is spectacular. You have two armies, both of them holed up on the hills and into the mountainsides, and on the floor, the valley floor, is where the battle should take place. Goliath marches his way in the middle of that text, or in the middle of that valley in this text, and he issues a challenge to the people of Israel every single day. Now, the Bible tells us that he was 6 cubits tall and a span. Now, depending on how you define those, that would put Goliath between 8.5 feet and 9.5 feet tall. Now, there is actually some questions about this because there are some ancient biblical manuscripts that say 4 cubits and a span. That would put him somewhere between 6.5 and 7 feet tall. But it would still been an impressive individual. For my own part, I think that the 8 to 9 foot measurement is probably right. We do know that there are many documented cases throughout history of people who were in fact that tall. And we get this impressive description of his battle armor. In fact, I was talking to my brother, who's actually been studying through this text, teaching it to a group of teenagers in his church just yesterday, and he said to me, he goes, the description of the Philistines' or Goliath's armor, he said, it's kind of annoying how detailed it is. But that's done with a purpose. His coat of mail is listed as 5,000 shekels. That would have been about 126 pounds. The spear would have been a javelin with a pole that had a loop on the end of it with a cord attached. Its equivalent weight was about 15 pounds. You just think about the strength of a man who could wear that into battle and could chuck that javelin with that kind of weight upon it. And for 40 days, he comes out and he issues the challenge for a one-on-one battle. And along the way, we get this statement in verse 10. And the Philistine said, Goliath said, I defy the armies of Israel this day. I defy them. Now, we may not understand the significance of that in our culture, but in the ancient Near East, when one army or people conquered another, it was a sign not only of their power, but also the power of their God. This is a statement that has religious overtones and connotations. Defying Israel's army was defying Israel's God. That, by the way, is how David took it, if you listened carefully as we read through that passage earlier. David saw this as an assault upon his God. Well, we read something tragic in verse number 11 as this challenge is put forward. Saul and all Israel, when they heard the words of this Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. And notice that it's not just the people in the ranks. It's Saul, the king. He is afraid and dismayed. You know what that means? They were in utter panic. They had no answers. They didn't know where to go, which is stunning if you know anything about what's happened so far in the first 16 chapters of 1 Samuel. Where they should have gone is to look up to God. But all they were doing was to look at human means and human ways to solve a big size, God size problem. Now, sometimes when you read the Bible, you miss obvious things. And I was studying this text this week again, and I never really considered the significance of the height of Goliath and the height of Saul. Remember that when we first meet Saul in 1 Samuel, that as he's introduced, the text emphasizes that he was literally head and shoulders above everyone else. In that day, the average man was about 5.5 feet, 5'7" tall. We know that because of archaeology. That meant that Saul was probably at least 6.5 feet tall. For his day, he was a big man. That's what made him so impressive. He looked the part of a king. And yet, he, the one person in Israel that should have been lined up against Goliath, he's afraid. He's dismayed. He's hidden in his temporary courtroom, a tent, far away from that valley. That leads us to our second section, and that is David's commission. David's commission. You see that verses 12 through 22. Well, in contrast to mighty King Saul, we see David in verse 12. And we're reminded again where he came from. He's the son of Jesse. He's one of eight children, eight sons. The three oldest have gone off to battle. We know, according to chapter 16 in 1 Samuel, that David had been summoned to the court of Saul to play music and to calm him. But this was apparently a semi-permanent relationship. He would have returned home quite often with his various responsibilities. Likely there were a number of court assistants for Saul, and probably there were other musicians as well that played. So David would on occasion go home to help keep the family farm, so to speak. And so at this point you have Saul, who's marched off with the army to battle, and David, he goes home to take care of some things while he has a break. And he gets home and his father Jesse asked David to take some treats to his sons, and more than treats, they would have been essential nutrition for them. Supply lines were not so formal back there. And even if we think about our own nation's history, if you know anything about the Civil War, you can think about how difficult it was to set up supply lines. Often you would have locals who would provide, women often would provide food for the troops as they were coming through, as they were able. This is kind of like that. But Jesse has an ulterior motive here. He wants to see how his sons are doing. We know at least for 40 days, Goliath has been marching out on that valley floor and trumpeting his challenge to the people of Israel. That means that at least 40 days his sons have been gone, probably quite a bit longer. And you don't have texting, and you don't have phone calls, and there's no Instagram, and there's no status updates, there's no live battlefield reporters out there. And so he, as a, probably a good dad who's aged, was concerned about his sons. Bring back news, he wants to know in verse 18. Were they alive? How was the battle going? These were the kind of questions that any father would want to know. Well, David does his commission. He does what his father tells him to do. We see again that he's a good young man. And he gets there, and as he gets there, the armies are lining up against each other. They've come down out of the hills. They're preparing for battle on the valley floor. He leaves the supplies that his father had sent with him with the supply keeper. In verse number 22, he finds his brothers. He does his commission. That leads us to section number 3, or scene 3 here, and that is David's concern. David's concern. You see that in verses 23 through 30. Now, David was there for the right reasons. He was there doing his father's bidding. But while he's speaking with his brothers, Goliath comes out in verse 23 and repeats the same words that he had done for the past 40 days. And the army who was preparing for battle shrinks back. They lined up. As soon as Goliath comes up, they pull back. And the men begin to talk in verse 25, and David overhears this. Apparently, Saul could not muster the courage to face Goliath himself, so he had put out a plea at some point that if he could get someone to go out and face Goliath and defeat him, he would not only get great riches, he would not only not be taxed, nor his father's household be taxed, but also he would get the king's daughter. He would marry into the king's family. So this is not like, you know, if you go into a store and they say, hey, we'll give you a $50 gift card if you sign up for a credit card, right? This is like a really big deal. This is life-changing things for your family and for yourself. Well, David overhears this in verse 26, and so he asks about it. But notice what David's real concern was in verse 26. What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine? I heard this, and notice this, takes away the reproach from Israel. That's what David's concern was. He's watching this person defy Israel and thus defy Israel's God, Jehovah, Yahweh. David saw this rightly. This is really actually a sad commentary and weight upon Israel. And it was sad because what it said about Israel's God. For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? David saw this as a real concern. So he's asking about it. What should be done? What are we going to do about this? And David's oldest brother, Eliab, heard this conversation. And whether Eliab was trying to be the big brother who protected David or was just irritated about his little brother's questions, he's upset. He's angry. And so he grills David. Why did you come down here? And with whom have you left those few sheep? That's just like a really knock against your little kid brother. I know the pride. I know the insolence of your heart. You've just come down to here to see a battle. You left those sheep and you came down here just to see what's going on. Here's my translation of this. You little punk, get out of here. You got no business being here whatsoever. Go home and play with your toys. Now, David would have been, by the way, a relatively young man. There's some debate on this, but it seems that probably around the age of 22 or 23 was the legal age in which you could enter into the king's army. Likely David would have been younger than that. So in some sense, Eliab has the right to say, you shouldn't be here. But David's response in verse 29, as paraphrased by one commentator, is excellent. What have I done to offend you? I happen to have been asking about a very important question here. A question that nobody else is apparently willing to seriously talk about. Well, that leads to David's court appearance in verses 31 through 39. David asks several people about this, and so word gets back to Saul that someone in his camp is at least interested in taking up his offer, so he brings David in for questioning. And David's confidence in the Lord just breathes out of him. Then David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine." And Saul, and you can just almost see this, you can almost imagine him looking him up and down. And he sees this young man coming in, says, "You are not able to fight and to go and fight against this Philistine, for you are a youth, a man, and he's a man of war from his youth." That's another indication when he uses that word youth. You're not even old enough to be here. Now, I'm sure Saul was thinking, this is the kid who played the harp, and now he's going to go take on a giant? That made no sense to him. It reminds me of when I was a young man, I was engaged to Casey, I was 21, and I was looking to buy a house. We were looking to buy a house, and I met with a good financial guy I knew, and he recommended that I meet with a lady at a bank that he had worked with, and he said, "Tell her I sent you." So I set up a meeting. And at age 21, I was still in college. I had basically no credit. I had one part-time job and the promise of another one when I graduated a couple months later from college. And I sat down in front of her, in front of his desk, and I laid out my plan with my finances. And at the time, I thought she was kind of old. Don't be offended at this. She was probably close to 60, but when you're 21, everybody looks old, right? Now I go, "Oh, that's not that far away." You know, like, you know. But at the time, I was like, "She looks old." I was dressed up really carefully. I was in a shirt and a tie. I presented all the options I had for paying back this loan. But I could tell she was not impressed. She literally did that thing where she's just looking me over. I'll never forget this, and I don't really impugn her to this day, but I felt it was really condescending. She leaned over against her desk, and she said these words. She said, "Son, nobody is ever going to give you a loan." Now, I said something then. I'm not usually a responder real quick of things that I shouldn't say, but I was really irritated with that. And I said, "Ma'am, this is in 2004. This is the height of like the housing bubble in the United States." I said, "Ma'am, they're giving dead people a loan these days. Somebody will give me a loan." "Well, son, it's not going to be this institution." And that was the end of that meeting, right? But I remember when she said that to me, that man, oh, it felt so cutting. Well, you have that kind of thing with Saul here. Who are you? You have no right to be here at all. Well, David responds, he had killed a lion, he'd killed a bear that threatened his father's sheep. And then we get where David's real hope lies in verses 36 and 37. We have several statements from David in this text that just are amazing at his confidence in God. "Your servant, I'm coming before you, Saul, I'm serving you." And think about this, he knew that he was the anointed king. "Your servant has killed both a lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God. Moreover," David said, "the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, the Lord will deliver me from the hand of the Philistine." David's confidence was in the Lord, plain and simple. And that becomes obvious when you have David trying on Saul's armor in verses 38 and following. It's kind of a funny scene. It's not quite the little kid who puts on dad's shoes and tries to walk through the house, but it's pretty close to that. And he's got a helmet that's too big, sinking over his eyes. He's got probably a coat of mail that's going past his knees. He's got a sword that's too long and too heavy for him. It's not that he hasn't even trained in them. They're too big. He can't even walk in them, much less go to battle. And so David says, in essence, "I don't need these." There are, by the way, a number of contrasts here between Saul and David. You could list many, but let me just point out three. First, Saul was willing to go into battle, was willing to go into battle without armor, whereas Saul would not. Second, David didn't look at the outward appearance. Saul simply looked at the size of Goliath. And third, David looked to the Lord. David was willing to look to the Lord. Saul was not. Now this leads us to section 5, and that's David's confidence. David's confidence. David goes and selects 5 stones. And if you have in your mind a little cute little river rock or small stone like that, you should get a very different thought in your mind. If you do any study on the history of slingers, they were a thing in that day, and even up into Greco-Roman times. People who used slings would often have stones that were the size of tennis balls. They were huge. You could whirl them over your head. Some of them did them that way with a sling. They weren't like the Y-shot or wrist rocket slingshots. You could whirl them over your head, or some would shoot them from the side. They were powerful stones. They weren't little skipping stones. They were rounded and big. We need to remember that when David went out to battle with Goliath, he did so expecting to have a fight. So he takes 5 stones with him. I don't think there's anything significant under that other than he expected, I might have to shoot more than once. Whatever the case is, he had these fairly large stones in his sling. And when we hear about this sling, you need to understand how powerful these are. People have done studies on these things. You can find videos today of people who replicate what these can do. These slings could easily shoot these rocks, these giant stones that were the size of tennis balls, over 100 miles an hour in speed. Slings were not thought well of. They were thought of as a poor man's weapon instead of a well-armed infantry a man's garb. But nonetheless, they were effective weapons. And that sets us up well with the scene with Goliath. They step out in the valley. According to verse 42, you get another guy, another big guy looking down at David, literally looking down at David and going, this little punk, he's nothing. And so he disdains him in verse 42. And David's response in verses 45 through 47, they're worth reading again. He says to Goliath, you come to me with a sword, with a spear, and with a javelin. Those were all impressive things. And we saw how big and heavy and powerful of weapons those were. But I come to you, David says, not with a sword, not with a javelin, not with a spear. I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you and take your head from you, and I will this day give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the wild beasts. Now, why did David want all of those things? Was it for his own glory and honor? No, verse 47. Then all this assembly shall know that the Lord does not save with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's. It's the Lord who will give you into our hands. That's where David's confidence was. This is clear evidence that David knew God, and David knew God's intention for Israel. The role of Israel was to be a means by which all the nations around her would know that there is a God in heaven who is worthy of worship and praise. That's what David was concerned about. David wasn't interested in building great monuments for himself. If you remember back in chapter 15, after Saul had this great victory in battle, that he builds a monument for himself. David wasn't interested in that. He was interested in the glory of God being known. And so as he declares this, this God-defying giant rumbles across that floor of the valley, and David hurried toward him. And you can picture this young man, probably in his late teens, maybe very early 20s, hurtling across that valley floor. And he launches one of those stones, and it speeds through the air. The text tells us that it sank into his forehead, probably indicating that it cracked his skull. And you have this incredible description in verse 49. The giant falls down face first into the dirt. Boom. You know, in that moment, I don't know what the valley was like. You got all those armies on one side or the other. Were the Philistines gasping and the Israelites cheering immediately? I suspect there was probably a murmuring. What in the world is happening? And they watch this young guy take this giant sword with the Philistine laying there face down in the earth, and he hacks his head off. That's a graphic scene. Right in front of everyone. And when they saw that, everything broke loose. The Philistines had heard that speech, and they knew that there was a God in Israel. The people of Judah and Israel heard that speech, and they remembered that there was a God in Israel. And they charged across that valley. The Philistines fled, and they plundered their tents in the process. Well, that leads us to our last scene. I'll just say briefly, this is David's climb. He, after this, goes and meets with Saul. We read in verse 55 where Saul asks his commander, Abner, whose son is this youth? This is a little bit of a flashback. This is not that Saul didn't know who David was, but probably didn't know much about David's family. He just promised this kid that if he won in battle, he would give one of his daughters to him in marriage. Probably he's like, who are we giving these tax breaks for if this happens? You know, like, what's the deal here? So he's trying to sort all of this out and figure this out. Abner says, I've never seen this young man in my life. You know, he was the commander of the battle. He wasn't in the courtroom often when David was playing his harp. He was probably out fighting and training troops. David comes in, verse 58, I'm the son of your servant Jesse, the one from Bethlehem. And David is suddenly launched into the position of being praised in the courtroom of the king. And we started out our time together by asking what this passage is not about. This passage is not about our ability to conquer giant problems in life. It's not about God being the great giant killer, so whatever giant challenge you have, God can kill it. He can do that, but that's not what this passage is ultimately about. Here, let me give you just one simple application as we think about this text. Because God is greater than everything, if we believe in the God that David believed in, because God is greater than everything, we never judge our circumstances merely by physical metrics. If God is great, as David believed, we never judge our circumstances by merely physical metrics. That means if God tells us to do something, we don't hesitate because it looks scary or doesn't seem to fit our scheme of how things should operate. In short, as believers in the God of heaven, we trust God and we do things God's way. That's what this text is telling us. God tells us to do something, we do it God's way. My dad has told this story many times. In fact, he just told it to a few people yesterday as well. I didn't know about this till much later in my life. But when I graduated high school, I wanted to work that summer as a camp counselor at Camp Chautauqua. I had been asked to consider that by the camp director, who was then Mike Duffy. Mike was a friend, and I knew him. My family knew him. But my dad was very hesitant. He felt that I should work because, quite frankly, we didn't have a lot of money. My dad had pastored poor churches and was not paid well, and paying for college was a real significant challenge. But dad also knew that I was interested in ministry and pastoral ministry, and that's weighing around and rolling around in his mind. And Mike Duffy called up my dad, and I didn't know about this till years later, and had this conversation. And in it, as my dad would say to you if he was here, Mike said to him, when are you going to start teaching your son to live by faith? Those are hard words for a pastor to hear. My dad said that that just struck him hard. Initially, he was just ticked. He's like, by faith, I've lived poor for most of my life, serving churches and rebuilding them. What do you mean by faith? Those words rang around in my dad's mind. And I wasn't sure what was going to happen. It didn't seem like I was going to go and serve that summer. But my dad would later call Mike back and say, you were right. So he just came to me and he said, hey, you know what? The Lord's going to take care of things. Go serve the Lord this summer. The Lord will take care of the bills. And that's what I did. You know, that summer, humanly speaking, if we hadn't done that, I wouldn't be here. Because that summer, I met my wife, where God began to work in my life significantly. It opened up opportunities for where I would go to church, meet George Cable's wife's cousin, and that's how we ended up here. I mean, the Lord had called us to do something, called me to do something, and it was like, are you going to do it God's way, or are you going to trust your own means? You can't just judge things by human metrics. If the Lord has given you direction in something, especially if it's a clear command, we trust in the Lord. He is able. We often judge things by purely physical metrics. That was Saul's problem. He just looked at the size of the army. He looked at the size of the spears. He did not look at the size of his God. I think in the Bible of saints, and I think what would happen if they had judged things purely by human standards? Remember Paul in Philippians 4 saying these words, for I've learned in whatever state I am, therewith to be content. I know how to be abased. I know how to abound everywhere and in all things. I've learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. What if he had looked at things from a human metric and standard? he would have instead wrote something like this: "For I have learned that if I save and plan and scheme enough, check with the marketing team, consider the cultural moment, and ask what the pagans think I should do, then it just might work out and God will take care of me." You know, sometimes what we need to do is say, you know, God, you've commanded me to do something. It may be hard, but I'm going to do it your way. I'm not going to look to the world's methods and ideas to solve the problems that are in my life. So as we think about this text, can I just ask this simple question? Is there something in your life where you know that you should do something because God has commanded it, but you don't want to do it because you're judging it by the wrong standards? Standards of what people think, what could go wrong. Instead, live by faith and say, God said it, God called me to do it, I will obey and I will trust in the living God. If there's something in your life where you're failing in that area, would you consider that now? Repent and change your ways. Father in heaven, I pray that you would use these words for the glory of your name, for the good of your people. You and your grace have given us this wonderful account that reminds us that you are a great God. I pray in the end of this day that we would trust and believe and live as if that's true. And we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.